From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 607, Building Microsoft Graph with guest Jeremy Thake, recorded Thursday, September 13th, 2018. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio, bringing back my friend Jeremy Thake, who the last time you were on the show was like October of 2016 when you worked for Microsoft. Now you work for Microsoft again. Here's the new bio. Jeremy Thake is a senior program manager in the Microsoft Graph engineering team. He's developed the Microsoft platform since 1998. He has worked as a developer consultant, VP of product at large, and small ISVs. And Jeremy's spoken at conferences, tweeted, blogged, and run podcasts for over 10 years. And in his spare time, he's raising a beautiful daughter with his wife in Seattle and screaming at the New York Rangers to shoot the puck. Oh, man. I don't know why we like each other. If you're a Rangers fan, there's something wrong with that. That's not right.
Well, I'm figuring you've got to support some team being Canadian. Living in Canada, at least.
Well, I got to support the Canucks. I don't have a choice. I live in Vancouver. That's how this works, right? They'll kick me out for crying out loud. There's no other options.
Well, we don't currently have a team here in Seattle, and I did drive up 1 week. I took a week off and saw 3 games in a week.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And realized that they suck more than the New York Rangers do.
They're so broken right now, dude.
The Twins are great, but, you know, they're not on the ice all the time. So for the rest of the time when they're not playing, it's kind of boring.
Well, we're in a new phase because the Twins finally retired, and they were both $7 million a year. You know, a lot of budget got freed up. A lot of the cap got cleared off. So they're in a rebuild. You know, it's a new season starting now when we're recording this, so they're optimistic they're actually going to make the playoffs this year because they haven't for the past couple.
Yeah, it's kind of important, especially for those season ticket holders.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's definitely hurt them. And it would be awesome to have Seattle have a team. I think it would be great.
Well, there was a bit of an announcement last week around 2 decisions that the council put through that got it that little stage further. So I think there's a final announcement in October that it's definitely going to go ahead. And then I think the bulldozers are waiting with the big red button to start digging the hole.
It'll be fantastic. We'll have so much fun with that. So, look, you were working at Microsoft. I think last show we talked about Azure App Service, but you were, you know, pretty close to Graph and all those things. And then you went off to do a startup. You worked with Hyperfish. And I know I did some shows with Chris, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Around that.
CJ Chris, as everyone knows him externally. And I have been really good friends for a long time and been to Formula One events together and, you know, always hang out here in Seattle. And he was actually my manager at Microsoft when I first started in the office role. And he left and started Hyperfish. And we always said, you know, if the opportunity, if we grow quick enough, we can come on board and kind of drive the outbound kind of marketing evangelism aspect of the product and help with it, drive the product from a PM perspective. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity came up and I'd been at Microsoft for 3 years, but at the age I was at, I was like 36 then, I just thought, I'm always going to regret this if I don't try it before kind of being a Microsoft lifer. So the intent was to stay there for like the 5 years and see what happens.
Yeah.
And in May of this year, so four months ago, they got acquired by a company called LiveTiles, which is another Australian company that's now headed in New York, who has been in the kind of Microsoft 365 collaboration portal space for a long time.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so I had the decision of either staying there or kind of coming back. And I decided to come back. Coincidentally, Yina Arenas, who people would have seen on stage in the Ignite keynotes and Build keynotes demonstrating the graph, timely spoke to me at an MVP bash that had gatecrashed and said she had a role open on the engineering side of the Microsoft graph. And just timing really aligned to make that happen.
It's rare to find folks that, you know, most Microsoft employees that I've met are lifers, right? They literally got hired out of university, either an MBA or a comp sci degree, and they stay in. And it's interesting to see you come and go, but also to go between the, you know, marketing side and the engineering side. That, to me, seems like you're really a well-rounded person when it comes to representing Microsoft.
Yeah, I was a developer in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a full-time dev cutting code every day. And then when I moved to America, I first started in New York and I worked for a company called AvePoint.
I remember.
As the VP of product there. And I guess most IT pros have probably heard of them or been to their parties at the big events.
Yes. Well, and the first show we ever did together, you with AvePoint.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I did a PM role there, which I kind of bridged marketing and PM because they needed help on the marketing side.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an MVP at the time. But then when I joined Microsoft as a marketing side, I found that it didn't really get my technical chops going. I was right. in PowerPoint a lot and taking polished demos and running them on stage, which I really enjoy doing. But I wanted to get closer to the actual doing of the work, of building it. And so when Yina came to me and offered me this engineering role, for me, that was like okay, let's get back into this a bit more and get more involved in product specifications and working with the engineering team to actually building the graph inside Microsoft.
That's awesome. So what aspect of graph are you responsible for?
So for right now, I own the developer experience all up on the graph.
Okay.
So essentially, wherever you hit us publicly, whether it's the website, whether it's the documentation, I work closely with Daryl Miller, who joined the graph team as well on the SDKs.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to start kicking off projects on things like, what's the story for us in Visual Studio Code and Azure Functions, the paths that can plug into the graph and logic apps and different things like that. So essentially, everything a developer touches around the graph that isn't the API itself is what I own from a PM side, with a lot of partner teams and peers that touch it in different ways. Kind of I'm overseeing of it all.
How do you describe graph? Because I feel like its sort of mission and concept has changed over the past few years.
Yeah, you're right. I guess fundamentally, it's the API for Microsoft, or mm-hmm. that's the intent over time. It started as mail, calendar, contacts, and then files, which was basically the Outlook and the OneDrive orgs.
Right.
Getting chummy internally and deciding that, you know, rather than us go away and build our own API endpoints, wouldn't it make sense to have this shared common way of building an SDK and a common way of doing an API schema and the same auth layer and different things like that.
And if I'm picking up what you're putting down here, it's that these are the APIs that Office 365 itself calls into as well, and you're just exposing them so we can use them also?
Yeah, and there's partly that. Some of the clients go directly through the graph.microsoft.com URL,
mm-hmm.
and others will actually go through the internal layer. So they don't go through the public kind of layer. They come in through the internal layer. And it depends on, you know, where the client is and what it's using.
Sure.
So a lot of like the server side products that we own are still calling the internal layer of what the graph exposes externally. But as an example, just today we were talking, the Intune team, all of their APIs are mm-hmm. on the graph, and their entire UI within the Azure portal is using the graph API.
Nice.
And so what that means is that whatever you can do in the UI, you can essentially do in the API. So just today I was getting ready for a demo at Ignite where I'm going to basically remote wipe Yina's phone for an API call, which right. is going to be quite fun on stage.
I'm, you know, as someone who's worked close to Microsoft for many, many years, anytime I'm looking at an API to use that I know Microsoft product teams are also using, like I like that. That gives me confidence that this is sticking mm-hmm. around, that it's important, that those Microsoft teams are certainly pressing the API guys to make it as good as it needs to be. So it's just that's a righteous path to be on.
Yeah, it's the first party, third party thing. It's sure. a little bit like Azure DevOps, as it's now known. Like
mm-hmm.
VSTS has been used by, every engineering team that I'm working with right now. And so, you know, there is ultimate feedback getting back to that team on what they need to do to improve that product for our own benefit, let alone external customers that are using Azure DevOps as well.
Yep. No, it's very true.
And the graph is the same thing. I think that's the big kind of difference now of rather than having this, here's the third-party API that you can use, and then they use something else that's special and hidden that can't be got at. And now, you know, there's this investment that, you know, first-party equals third-party.
So if, you're using Office 365, you're using Graph, whether you know it or not. Are there reasons for an IT group to be thinking about Graph in other roles inside of the organization?
Yeah, and I think my learning from coming back in role is that, you know, where the Graph was positioned as kind of Office 365, the reality right now is it's really broader. It's more Microsoft 365.
Right.
And what I mean by that, you know, for people still catching up on the marketing spin is it's Office 365 plus Windows 10 plus the Enterprise Mobility Suite as it, they were kind of known as individual buckets brought together. And so a lot of the security APIs are available on the Microsoft Graph, which, you know, sure are Office 365, but they also don't need to necessarily be around Office 365.
Right.
Or, you know, for all liking internally are a different division. And so it is definitely broader than Office 365. And the intent eventually is that, you know, it will be the one API across Microsoft. And, you know, that's not going to happen overnight. And there is a certain amount of us internally having to go convince these different product teams that here are the benefits of coming on board us, which we do. But I think from an IT perspective, there's a few avenues of, you know, where this is going to come up. And literally just had a, I was going to say EBC, but an executive briefing with a very, very large multinational company last week who had their senior architects in the room. And we're talking about the fact that all these ISVs are coming to them now. And, you know, gone are the days where they go, here, here's the install and just put your service account usernames and passwords in here. You know, the model's changed to where these applications now require the user who's using the application to consent permissions rather than having these kind of God mode service accounts. You know,
right.
There's a lot more consent on the user or consent by the organization within the management consoles in the Azure portal. And so IT pros really need to be aware of that.
Do we actually go so far as to start to call them claims?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, in the UI, people that are familiar with maybe I always use the rollback to like the Facebook-esque, the farm app where, you know, like you install it and it's going to ask, can I have access to all your Facebook contacts? And,
right.
You know, sure, you say yes. And then that gives them access to then go find all your friends and tell them about Farmville.
Right.
And it's essentially the same thing internally. It's like when you install, and I'll use Hyperfish as an example of somewhere I've just come from, that app's going to consent that it's going to need read access to the user profiles within the organization to go check the profiles are complete up to date. And then if the admin decides that Hyperfish can then go update those based on getting the information of the users, it'll also have to go get a claim to say that it has permission to write back to those profiles as well.
Typically, we talk about claims being granted to user. I really kind of like this idea of users granting consenting claims as well. It's like, yes, you can have access to that or you can use that information. That's pleasing to me. It's a nice symmetrical model.
And also from a visibility perspective as an admin, I can start to see, you know, who's consenting what across my organization.
Sure.
And catch things and be like, whoa, why has Jeremy just consented full, you know, read write to pretty much every entity within his Office 365 environment? Like, or in the case with things like the cloud app security portal, where you can actually block that and say that, look, gone are the days of giving out username and password, which would give them everything.
Right.
But, you know, you can go and give an app consent to access your calendar, but we're not allowing any applications in the entire organization to have access to your inbox, for instance.
Right.
And so, you know, there's definitely this better visibility into how is all the data in my organization leaving, and you'll be able to see it because you better see what applications have access to what particular data sets inside of, you know, for now Microsoft 365, but, you know, eventually everything across Microsoft.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And how do you, as an administrator, see those rights, those claims? Is there a tool for that?
Yeah, so inside of Azure Active Directory, so if you go to portal.azure.com, or as I found out the other day, the quick way to just get there is aad.portal.azure.com.
Oh, wow.
You'll see all of the list of your enterprise applications, and that will show you across your entire organization, anyone who's in given consent to an application has access via Azure Active Directory and all the permissions that have been granted either at the user level or at the admin level, which gives it a little bit more kind of leveled control. And then the Cloud App Security Portal is a way of kind of adding more control and even more visibility into, you know, what data's coming and going and setting up rules of, you know, if someone tries to consent an application, they can have that nixed and stopped from being able to be consented in the first place. And that, I believe, is moving into the admin center, whereas right now I think it's a separate portal because it was kind of a new thing that had been incubated and released to the public.
Cool. And Jeremy, give me one moment for this very important message. This episode of Run As Radio is brought to you by SQL Intersection. 8 full-day workshops and over 40 technology-focused sessions make SQL Intersection a unique source of the best information around SQL Server from real-world consultants and the members of the SQL Server team. You'll learn proven problem-solving techniques and technologies you can implement immediately, as well as learn about the future of SQL Server. Get answers to performance monitoring, troubleshooting, designing for scale and performance, cloud, as well as new features in the latest version of SQL Server. It's time to determine your migration strategy, and SQL Intersection is the place to figure out the best way to do it. Come to SQL Intersection at the MGM Grand Hotel in Las Vegas, December 3rd to 6th. Use the code RUNAS to get your discount on your registration at thesqlintersection.com, and I'll see you there. And we're back. Richard Campbell, it's Run As Radio, talking to Jeremy Thaik about Microsoft Graph and its sort of evolving capabilities. I remember, it must have been a couple of builds ago, there was this term Project Rome, R-O-M-E, that they were talking about, again, visibility into what accounts with what devices, with what applications, with what rights, like just that sort of picture. I guess that's got to have been all subsumed into Graph.
Yeah, so Project Rome is available on the beta endpoint of the Graph. So we have this notion with the Graph that there's a V1 endpoint, which is production ready, and the contract between us and developers, it won't change.
Right.
Whereas with the beta or beta, depending on where in the world you're from, I can't remember which one's right anymore. Australia and England and America, and now I'm just like chameleonized depending what I feel is right at the time.
If you're talking to Americans, it's beta. If you're talking to Aussies, it's beta.
My grandmother always tells me, oh, you sound too American now. I'm like, in America, they tell me I still sound English, so I'm just kind of ruined wherever I go.
The Canadians say I sound like an American, and the Americans say, you're not from around here, are you?
So Project Rome is on the beta endpoint, which
means
that it's not quite ready to be V1. They're still gathering feedback from developers, and so potentially they could change, you know, the schema of the API or what the JSON post that you'd send in the API call or what it responds might change. So the documentation will typically evolve a little bit as it gets closer to V1. But the notion of Project Rome in its first kind of reveal was this idea that you could post alerts to your device. So when you're in your Windows 10 notification, you'll be able to actually send using the cards this ability to kind of notify and alert your users in Windows 10 of things that are going on based on using the user's ID that essentially is their Active Directory identity. And so that's kind of another example of like non-Office 365 Windows 10 stuff that's already in the Graph that's there that you can start playing with. And so, you know, as an IT pro, if you're already doing things around Windows 10, you know, it's a great example of an API that you can take advantage of, get your devs to build some stuff out around Project Rome.
Yeah, then that's an interesting sort of balance between this is that if, presuming that I have this great high-functioning team where when architectural and design decisions are being made about internal software, we actually involve our IT ops guys, which would be awesome, to be able to talk about how we're going to manage identity and rights and controls over all of that with these tools. I love everything about that. As long as we can get in early enough to encourage them to go that way, it takes that problem off the table, right? I'd rather run less LDAP in my life.
And I think the taking advantage of the new features in some of the products using the Graph is a nice touch, you know, like as a user experience thing. If you've rolled out Windows 10 and, you know, the timeline features that are now available, and I forget what build that got introduced, but I use this all the time now where I can click on it right near the microphone button within my search box in the bottom left and get up my history of everything that's been going on across my different Windows 10 environments I have. I run around campus with a laptop, but I have a nice big developer machine under the table that I use. You know, it has those cards that show me what I've been doing in Edge and what I've been doing in Outlook and PowerPoint and Hockey App, for instance. But you can, as an enterprise application, also be present in those things. So if you've got an invoicing system and you've got a, you're approving an invoice, you could post that particular approval into your timeline so that as a user in Windows 10, I click on that and I could just launch my enterprise application directly to that view. And, you know, that's super productive for people as they're jumping between the devices. And just one example of, you know, here's why you should move to Windows 10.
Well, and I remember talking about this at Build, because I think it was 1803 that got Timeline. And they were talking about it at Build because, you know, all the Microsoft people have been using it for a while with one of the insider builds, but most people hadn't seen it yet. And, you know, if you go back and listen to some of my August shows, we're talking about update problems. Like, there's plenty of organizations that have held off on 1803 because of other problems with the update. So people haven't seen this feature. I think it's very cool and really, you know, starting to see rewards around stuff like Graph with those kinds of capabilities. It's just, you know, I don't think a lot of organizations have had a chance to take advantage of it yet, just because they're dealing with their own issues on updates. And it's amazing how difficult updates can be.
Yeah. And you mentioned the LDAP thing and you know, managing usernames and passwords. Like, I remember the issues of setting up enterprise applications where you'd have in the config, even if it was encrypted, usernames and passwords for service accounts. And then, you know, some IT pro goes and changes or resets those passwords for whatever reason.
Yep.
Due to some kind of like policy renewal process and breaks a lot of those applications. You know, with this notion of consent, there aren't any passwords. It's all based on, you know, the admins going in or the users going in and physically seeing those consent windows and clicking the buttons. And then it's up to the apps then to manage the tokens they receive as part of that consent process and keep them refreshed. So it's certainly a lot easier to manage those kind of things with this approach than it is in those days with usernames and passwords, for sure.
Man, it's a much better model. And I don't want new software brought into my organization that's depending on doing their own authentication. You know, this is the first thing I've seen that really makes me start to believe in an idea of single sign-on that is not also homogeneous. You know, we were pretty good at single sign-on when everything was a Windows domain joined machine. It's just not realistic in the modern world.
Yeah, and Teams actually is a good example of that. When you launch Teams, if you're logged into Windows 10 as a Teams user, it's actually doing an AAD single sign-on that then calls the Graph API to load your Teams UI up. And so that's just like at one of our biggest examples of that working really smoothly from a, you know, you don't need to sign in if you just go, you know, sign in as the person on my machine.
Right.
And there's a bunch of other examples of that when Outlook prompts you for your credentials again. And maybe this is only an MSIT thing, but I'm pretty sure I've seen this in my own mailboxes where rather than having to replug your password back in, you can just basically say, no, sign me in as what I am on my Windows 10 machine as well.
Yeah.
So just experience-wise, it's better.
Yeah, absolutely. And as long as you have a common identity.
Yeah.
You know, one of the challenges that we're running into, and I haven't done a show about this yet, but it's certainly something I'm researching and looking into, because I've certainly run into it. Being a Canadian, you know, let's go multicultural, I have some live accounts that predate country mapping. So, of course, they were all dumped into the U.S., and that was fine. But then, you know, suddenly you need a proper Canadian account. So it's, I think I have half a dozen different accounts that are either MSA or AAD. Like, it's a mishmash. And it's very hard. The number of prompts that say, hey, you can log in less if you agree that this is your default account. It's like, I just cannot agree to that. I have a bunch of accounts. And they're not all straight.
Did you fall into the trap of having a email address that's the same as your organizational account?
Yes. On at least one certain case, yeah.
Yeah, I unrolled myself out of that mess a while ago because I realized that was just going to get too hard.
Well, and it's a really interesting conversation as an organization when we start going down the AAD path and these identities. Like, I want these features, but there's a strong case to be made. We've got a domain area with a bunch of email addresses that are already in MSAs with various privileges. Like, heaven help you have an MSDN account or anything like that. And then you throw it into Azure Active Directory as well. Like, it makes sense to almost do a separate domain for that.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is there's a lot of organizations that maybe hear the word Azure AD and freak out that, well, we're still on premise. And, you know, there are, you know, a lot of the organizations I work with in Hyperfish had an AD on premises as well as an Azure AD. And, you know, there was a one-to-one mapping there that meant that, you know, if they needed to go have applications that consented through Azure AD, that was the way they could handle that. And so you don't have to kind of be all in cloud for that kind of scenario to work too. And it just gives you so much advantage in terms of control and visibility of what all these applications are doing that your user base is using within your organization.
Absolutely. And at the same time, I'm very cognizant of the idea that you're never going to be all cloud. There's always going to be some on-premise stuff. Like hybrid is normal.
Yeah.
And so the line is complicated. Like it's just not that simple to figure all of that out and make it all work right. I mean, I'm optimistic that this will get solved. I've met enough of the identity folks to know there's talented people there. This is not a simple problem, but it's very frustrating.
Yeah, and I find a lot of the graph conversation, you know, a lot of it right now is around the identity space of authentication and, you know, application management and the security side and delegations of control. Like we had a great conversation with a company that said that there was a policy within the company that they would not allow any users to consent any applications and that you would require the administrator to use the app, consent it as an administrator instead, and then grant access to those applications at either a group or a user level instead. And right now, that whole process is a very manual process. It's something that the identity group are working on to have this ability to kind of, you know, rather than seeing you cannot consent this app, having a more friendly, you cannot consent, you can request your administrator consent it on your behalf, will become a more streamlined flow. But for right now, you know, if that's your policy, that's going to make life a little bit harder for you.
Yeah. You know, I have frustration with all of those absolutes. Like, it's a variation on the same thing of everybody's an administrator, right? It's
just, yeah.
Both extremes are wrong. You need to be able, because users will circumvent you. They need to get their work done. And if there's ways to do it, they will find a solution and you will be surprised how good they are at it.
Well, even in here, like people are using things like Trello and, you know, they share with you their Trello boards and you realize they're using their personal Gmail accounts to sign up for the services. There's not much you can do about that unless you start blocking Trello on the network.
How many Google Docs have I been shared from a Microsoft account? It's like, really? Really? But it absolutely happens. And again, it's like that might be a failure of education. That might be a security restriction. Like there's any number of reasons. But people's hearts are in the right place in the sense of mission one was get my work done.
Yeah. The other nice thing that I found that, you know, I've experienced this a lot when I was a full-time developer was, you know, spinning up developer environments for this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the day when I was working on SharePoint, for better or worse, I have a love-hate relationship with that product for sure.
Anybody who actually knows it well has a love-hate relationship.
especially on the dev side. Oh, but it has incredibly done really, really well recently in the last few years.
Oh, yeah.
But it's spinning up those environments. You know, I had to go spin up an AD server in a VM, a SQL server in a VM, and SharePoint in a VM. And managing Active Directory you know, as a developer is not something you typically do, but can guarantee that most devs out there are we're using a domain admin account to do absolutely everything.
Of course.
And then shipping their product to a staged environment that was locked down and suddenly your app doesn't work at all. And I think with this approach of really thinking about the permissions that you need your user to consent up front and having the developer actually define those as part of the consent flow in their applications kind of prevents all that mistake happening at the end of the process of, okay, we've demoed the app to the execs and they love it, but now we've got to get into staging and then we want to get into production. It causes all sorts of problems.
The idea that devs are working from administrator level accounts is just, it is the path of doom now.
Yeah.
Not only is it a vulnerability period because it's easy to get exploited. I mean, that's why admins are generally being attacked these days by the black hats, but also you'll never get it right. If you don't work on the security problem up front, you're just never going to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, it will highlight very quickly that maybe you've picked a permission that, again, is one of those ones where you shall not pass.
Yeah.
And you would catch that super, super early when you start sending around for demos for the various different stakeholders when they're like, oh, this isn't working for me. And it's like, well, yeah, because that has been a policy of the enterprise. You can't use this permission level.
Right.
And it would catch it in the bud really quickly rather than the share it around as a domain admin permission and catch it at the last hurdle, which I've been on projects where that's happened and it's been
sure
basically project ending.
Well, so you also have that forcing function of we need to increase the sophistication of our security model.
Yeah.
So we haven't used this term, but I'm wondering if it's true. The same way we talk about configuration as code, are we at the point with Graph of calling it security as code, that it provides that visibility, it provides repeatability on a writes set?
I quite like that. Yeah, I don't think we've ever got to that level. Yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely what it is too. Because, I mean, even in our docs, like every single operation you can do, we document the exact permission level that you require to do it.
Right.
So we're very permission heavy in terms of being respectful of that in the docs and in our SDKs. And we've got definitely a little bit of work to do. If you call the API and you do get a access denied, we're not often that good right now at saying you need this consent level to do this operation.
Right.
But that's something we're actively working on, which I've heard loud and clear from developers and IT pros that, you know, that is a little bit frustrating after the fact.
And the challenge, of course, is I need you to tell me what right I'm missing, but you don't tell anybody else. So it's like you have to have a privilege level to just be able to get that message. Because telling the hacker, you should go get this permission, that's probably not a good idea. But I really like that idea that I could add a claim to a dev that's otherwise in a regular domain user account that says you're allowed to see what rights you're missing. Like they'll give you the information like that. That's super empowering. Like, there's only certain places where you get to delight with security.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of them for sure. I mean, even adding that to the documentation, we did that prior to build. And the amount of times I've been told that that's like the saving grace of that documentation right now has definitely surprised me somewhat. But I mean, it's important. And I think that, you know, it brings security as a real key part of a developer's day-to-day doing that stuff, which is great.
Yeah. Make them feel empowered to own the rights and to keep at least privilege. And maybe there's a tier in there where it's like, you need this privilege and you're just not going to, you better talk to an admin to be able to grant this. It's at a certain level. Like that granularity. I also think anytime you can give someone an additional permission, it makes them feel special too, right? Like that, that's not a bad thing. It's like, oh no, you're not just a regular user. You're a user who gets to see a little more, right? The number of times back in the old days where it's like, you know, the head of IT who doesn't actually need any permissions wanted an admin account. And so I created him an account that had admin in the name, but gave him the incorrect password and waited to see if he ever complained about it. And he never used it. He just wanted to own it.
That's a great story.
So A, it was a guest account, and B, the password was wrong anyway. I just want to know.
Brilliant.
Then he tried to log in. You know, one of them actually tried to log in once, so I gave him the correct password. And then he never complained about his privilege level, and he had no privileges.
See, I do this these days now where I'll send a OneDrive link with a URL incorrect on purpose to make sure people are actually viewing it.
Yes, yes.
Maybe I'm a little bit too sneaky, but, you know, there are those times where you just think sneaky suspicious that people aren't looking at your doc.
This is productive cynicism right here. That's what this is. Productive cynicism.
And the other thing I wanted to point out as well, which a lot of people don't realize, is if you go to the broader parent of Office 365 developer site, which is what I used to work on, mm-hmm. was at Microsoft, dev.office.com, you can sign up for a developer program. And obviously, even if you don't have developer in your title, you can get one.
Right.
And, you know, it gives you an Office 365 tenant with 25 users. It is a specific SKU, so there are certain things that are blocked off, i.e., we don't want you running a small business on this.
Right.
And they do have like a shelf life, but it's super useful for organizations to be able to have those kind of environments. And, you know, it comes with a bunch of sample data in it too. So you can really kind of push the edges of the graph in terms of, oh, what does this API look like to get Megan Bowen's calendar, for instance, or she's my one I usually demo on because she's got the easiest alias to remember.
Right.
Yeah. Those environments are super useful to use as well for the developers that, you know, you're right. IT, typically they'll come to the IT guy within the organization and ask, how do I get this? And I think that's the easiest way to do it, quite honestly.
Yeah, very clever to have a good sandbox like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it. A half hour flew by, Jeremy. Thank you so much for the insight. And great to have you back at Microsoft working on Graph. Gives me confidence it's going to do the things we need it to do.
Yeah, let's hope so. It's been a lot of fun being back, I think, 3 months now. And I've really enjoyed it. And as I say, like, if people have got questions or feedback, my door is always open. You know, I'm taking it from this experience perspective and feeding it back to the other team. So if you're listening to this and you've got some gripes, definitely give me a ping on at Jay Thake on Twitter.
For sure. Or write a comment on the website. I'll send you a mug in the process. And
that's right. Go to the podcast. And congratulations to you. Just hit the 600 mark a few weeks ago, right?
600 shows, yeah. And your show's up and running again, right?
It is, yeah. So I rebooted it.
So this is the Microsoft 365 Developer Podcast.
That's right. M365devpodcast.com. Yeah. So we're about 12 shows in. We're doing it every week, myself and Paul Schaeffline. The audience is definitely more developer than IT pro, but you know, we do kind of tackle all the different angles of it as well.
Awesome. Good stuff. I'll include a link in the show notes. Jeremy Thake, thanks so much for coming on the show.
No, you're welcome, mate. Thanks again.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.